From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, a Patriot Act. It's a play running in Sacramento. It concerns the trial of a certain George W. Bush, where the audience is invited to be witnesses and jury. First, Oakley Hall times 2 is at the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley this weekend. By that, I mean both Oakley Hall the author and Oakley Hall the rock band will perform in an unusual double bill. A little later, we'll talk with the leader of the band, Oakley Hall, but first, the author. Oakley Hall was born in San Diego, but now lives part of the time in Nevada City. He's best known for his novels about the Old West, the most famous being Warlock. Oakley Hall has been writing novels for a long time. His first, Murder City, was published in 1949. His latest, Love and War in California, came out this year. Oakley Hall is also recognized as a mentor to writers, in part as co-founder of the Squaw Valley Community of Writers. He's on the phone. Oakley Hall, welcome to Insight.
Nice to be here.
Well, when you started writing books in the 40s, did you think you would still be writing novels in 2007?
No one thinks they're going to live that long. No, I didn't.
Yes,
I was looking one book at a time ahead of myself. That's where what I've been doing.
What got you started as a novelist? How you started as a novelist?
I started to write. I was a student at the University of Hawaii, where at that time it was very popular to be an aeronautical engineer, which I thought I wanted to be until I met up with engineering and found out we weren't going to get along together. But I took a creative writing course from a guy, and lo and behold, I got the first praise I'd ever had in my life. That caused me to want to be a writer and get more of it.
It would appear from at least some of your books that you have an interest in the Old West. Where did that come from?
Well, again, the story. When I was a boy, I lived next to the biographer of Wyatt Earp, Stuart Lake. He wrote a book called Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal. And living next door to him, I started reading about the West. Just went on from there.
Mm. Now, your book, Warlock, was made into a well-known film with Richard Widmark, Henry Fonda, Anthony Quinn.
Yes.
What did you think of the film? Was it a fair reversioning of your book?
Mostly. My book had a lot to do with labor. The miners were terribly treated and persecuted out in the Western mines. And that was a part of the book which they left out, understandably, because it would have made the movie way too long. And miners aren't as interesting as cowboys shooting each other up. But other than that, it was terrific. I mean, Henry Fonda, he just walked down the street, and you saw his whole character. And all the major characters were very satisfying to me.
A lot of the representation of the Old West in American books and TV and movies seems sentimental. How important did you think it was to find out what life would really have been like for real people in the West?
Well, I didn't really go at it that way. I tried to just tell stories other people had told, but tell them realistically rather than sentimentally. You know, in a stock Western, you get, what have you got? You got the hero, you got the villain, you got the whore with the heart of gold and the prim school teacher. That's about all you have to work with. And so I was trying to give the characters much more dimension than that. And I think sometimes, especially in Warlock, I think that succeeded.
My guest is Oakley Hall, the author. His latest novel is Love and War in California, and he's in an unusual double bill this Sunday evening at the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley, appearing with the rock band that's also called Oakley Hall. Well, tell us about your latest novel, Love and War in California. It's set in a time and place that you know well.
It's set in San Diego, which was my hometown. And it's set in most of it is in the first 6 months of World War II, which I can remember well. Some of the older listeners will remember that time because we were losing the war up until the Battle of Midway, which was about 6 months in. And after that, things went better. But before that, there was a lot of fear and consternation, especially on the West Coast. We were going to be invaded, et cetera.
What did you do during the war?
I was in the Marine Corps. I didn't get into action. I was on the island of Maui in amphibian tractors, and we were loading up for the invasion of Japan when the war stopped.
And how did your experiences during the Second World War influence you as a writer, if they did?
They didn't.
They didn't. Although I guess it gave you some material for your latest novel.
Actually, what gave me more material was a friend of mine who was in the Battle of the Bulge, who's a terrific storyteller. And I listened to his stories, and a lot of them I put to use in the middle part of my novel, which is about the adventures of my hero during the war.
You have a reading for us from Love and War in California. Could you tell us what we might need to know before you start the reading?
Yes, my hero is it's in World War II, and my hero is in Paris. And he's AWOL, and he's thinking of deserting. You know, there were a tremendous number of deserters in Paris. And he has a French girlfriend, and he's living with her, and this is a scene with her. Should I go ahead and read it?
Please do.
Corinne sat on the bed reading Le Monde. Fair cropped hair covered her head like pale flames. When they had shaved her head, she had let it grow out this far, now kept it cut short. Sometimes she wore a wig, but more often she faced down what she had to face down. With her sleeping with the bushy, cropped head, she hadn't read the Scarlet Letter, and my little French had failed trying to explain it to her. The old royal portable with its French accents I bought at the Marché Pousse rested on the little table. Allo, Pat. Allo, Corinne. I went over the window to look out over the rake wreaths of roofs, the twats of Paris. I said I was going to have to go back. Pourquoi? She said. No money. She said she could get money. It was impossible to explain that I was not suited to a life that seemed glamorous in theory and rebellion against the stupidities of war. In fact, being an AWOL hiding out in a hole in the mansard in Montmartre with a girl who would go out and peddle for money was for you, where every time you passed an MP you would want to check your orders as with the non-coms at transient messes and transient barracks. It was simply too deep. I picked up the splayed open paperback of Swan's Way and set it aside, seat myself in the rickety chair facing Corinne. She had a pasty, sweet face with startlingly black eyebrows below her cropped head. When she got up to come to me, her breath swung in her white blouse. She sat on my lap and traced a finger down my cheek and pressed her lips there with the popping little kisses. She had been in love with a German lieutenant and did not apologize for it. You will leave me, Pot, she said. Just for a little while, I said. I thought I could be a writer on the outside looking in spectatorly on the bourgeois bullshit of American life, but I would have to write about the bullshit from inside social reality, contemned to be just what I hoped to rebel against. My sweet boy, Corinne said. She smelled of soap and lavender. She propped my chin up to kiss me on the mouth, her narrow bottom squirming in my lap. She found the furrow of a scar in my thigh beneath my pants and traced a finger along it. My wound fascinated her. It was her conviction that most sorrows could be solved in bed, and so we tried that. That's it.
Thank you very much. Oakley Hall, reading from his latest novel, Love and War in California. Tell us how you set about writing nowadays. You've had plenty of practice. How do you approach writing a novel?
You used to sit down with a blank piece of paper and a typewriter. Now you sit down with a blank screen on the computer and feel guilty until you start filling it up. The way I do it, I've kind of conceived of the characters pretty well in my mind, and you get them talking together and things like that, and things begin to happen.
Yeah.
They're not always the right things, but you can fix that later.
Oakley Hall, the novelist, is in a double bill this Sunday evening at the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley, appearing with the rock band also called Oakley Hall. And on the phone is Pat Sullivan, who's a songwriter and founder of the rock band Oakley Hall, and he's a singer and guitarist in the band. Pat Sullivan, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Tell us
Although,
why.
Although I'm in an odd spot. I'm actually on the corner of 29 Palms Highway right outside of Joshua Tree in California. So the car, you might hear cars whizzing by.
Well, it's very atmospheric.
Yeah.
Now you,
Yeah. I'm trying to reenact an Oakley Hall story, maybe.
I see in your website that you're playing Pioneer Town tonight. Where exactly is Pioneer Town?
Pioneer Town is right on the outskirts of Joshua Tree National Park, about 3.5 hours east of L.A. And it's a really beautiful saloon, an old saloon that sees a couple of women from Williamsburg, the Williamsburg area of Brooklyn, purchased maybe a few years ago, and have been trying to kind of kick up a music scene around here. So every night they have live music, and for bands like ourselves in the kind of country rock vein or alt country vein or whatever you want to call it, it's kind of become an essential stop because they treat you really well, and there's a lot of really interested locals. That there's not a lot going on around here, so people like to come check out the tunes, and it's usually scheduled right around a day off, so you can go check out Joshua Tree National Park while you're here, and it's
very nice.
Always amazing.
Hi, Pat.
Hi, Oakley. Yeah, before I go on, I'd like to thank you. Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you.
We've never actually conversed.
We'll actually see each other in person.
I know, in a couple of days, right?
Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
That's on Sunday night in Grass Valley. Pat, how did the band come to be called Oakley Hall?
Well, I can take that one. I was I read Warlock and loved it. And I loved his name, and I actually didn't know very much about him, but I loved his name. I thought it had kind of a nice, regal, like stately quality about it, but also really mysterious and American. And the band that we were starting, you know, I wanted to have all those things. Have, you know, we're kind of refined in a way that we really like work at harmonies and stuff like that, but we also have this American thing, and but we're also kind of weird, and so
that's really flattering, Pat.
Yeah,
thank you.
So,
well,
sure.
Oakley, what do you make of that? What did you think when you first heard that a rock band was using your name as their name?
Well, it was my wife who found it out. She looked up my name on the internet, and there was this rock band there. They were taking up a lot more room on the page than I was, so we got interested in them. And got some of their records and liked them a whole lot.
Do you think your name has a stately sound? Because that's what Pat Sullivan said.
I hadn't thought of it until this moment.
It does.
It sounds like a British rest home, actually.
I think it is, actually. Well, it's a place in Britain as well. We actually get emails on our website for people wanting reservations for like wedding receptions and stuff in England. And we have to turn them down and say, sorry.
Maybe
we'll play it if you want. But
maybe we got to expand, Pat.
Yes. Yeah, maybe. But I also read I read Warlock, and I also just loved. I mean, I was listening a little bit ago, and Oakley was talking about how he just loved to take the kind of established tropes, like the hooker with a heart of gold, and you know the marksman in the West and stuff, and kind of breathe new life into it and tell the story like you know it would actually have happened as opposed to the fantasy aspects. And And, you know, I thought that when we were approaching the style of music, which has been pretty well-heeled itself, I mean, there's been decades and decades at this point of, like, so-called, like, Americana music, you know, harmonies and fiddles and like, twangy guitars or whatnot, which we wanted to approach it in a new way and think about, like, you know, great bands like, I don't know, Creedence Clearwater Revival even REM in the early 80s or great Nashville bands, the Great Nashville Acts or the Flatlanders from the early 70s or just bands that really kind of approached this kind of genre, which has a lot of genre rules about it, to kind of get in there and kind of bust it open and kind of do what you want with it and make it a more realistic, kind of gripping, exciting thing.
Well, Pat, we're running short of time, but we do have a clip from your band, and this is from your latest album, Merge, and it's the song I'll Follow You. Let's listen to a bit
great.
Of it.
Enemies and friends.
We have to go through this very quickly. Let's go to Sunday night, Oakley Hall, author. You're going to be reading from your works, I guess.
Well, you know, my daughter, the playwright, has dramatized some scenes from my novels. And she's got some really good actors to read them. I've heard them do one of these, and they're very good.
Great.
And I'm going to read very briefly, and then the band is going to play. That'll be fun.
So, Pat, you're going to be playing songs from the new album?
Yeah, we're playing songs from the new Merge record and probably a couple of old ones, and we'll see whatever else comes up. But we're looking forward to it, and sorry, I'm such a windbag.
That was great. Well, thank you both very much. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun up in Grass Valley on Sunday night. That's at the Center for the Arts on Sunday evening. Oakley Hall, the author, and Oakley Hall, the band.
Thank you.
Thank you
all
both
right,
very
thank
much.
You.
Goodbye. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison, host of Insight. Why do you listen to Insight and KXJZ? Is it for the in-depth coverage of local issues and local people? If so, please support both this program and the station with a generous donation. We're listener-supported, and that's why we're asking you, a listener, to join this afternoon. We're at capradio.org, 800-800-5867. Thanks very much. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. A play in Sacramento puts a certain George W. Bush on trial and asks the audience to give a verdict. The play is called A Patriot Act. It's produced by California Stage at The Space in Midtown Sacramento. While actors play many key roles in the staged trial of President Bush, audience members have the option of appearing to as witnesses and of serving on one of three juries. The playwright Todd Blakesley lives in San Diego, where A Patriot Act was first performed. He recently visited Sacramento for rehearsals of the local production, and he came to the Insight Studio with California Stage director Ray Tatter. I first asked Todd Blakesley how such a political play can stay current with news happening every day involving President Bush.
The script is constantly revised depending on what's occurring at the time. For example, just 3 weeks ago, there was a presidential order allowing the Secretary of the Treasury, in consultation with the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State, to seize property of U.S. citizens if they have done something that has contributed to the instability in Iraq. This is simply a presidential order. Now, that's brand new, and now that's in the play. And it wasn't in there prior to that presidential order.
So you're actually revising the script as needed, you know?
Absolutely. We need to stay current, and we also need to remind ourselves of the key points that have happened in the past as well.
Now, the play's subtitle is The Trial of George W. Bush. What is the president charged with in the play?
Well, there are three groupings, if you will, three charges. In fact, there are three juries in the play as well. And the first one deals with malfeasance in office. This would concern things like illegally allowing a warrantless surveillance of American citizens. It has to do with the use of signing statements and coercion of departments under his jurisdiction to accept his authority over that of legally passed legislation by Congress. The second one deals with war crimes, which, of course, one of the most obvious violations was the Geneva Conventions in regards to torture and illegally invading another country. That's a breaking of the UN Charter, the treaty that we have there. And the third one is treason, which gets into a number of issues that haven't really been addressed on the public scale. And the thing is that we want people to we're not making a definite statement one way or the other. We're presenting the evidence, and we're presenting also the defense of those as well. So both sides are brought out during this course of this trial.
Now, wouldn't the matters that you've just described, wouldn't those be the subject of impeachment hearings in the Senate as opposed to a criminal trial?
Well, yes, but impeachment, remember that the sole remedy of impeachment is removal from office. And only then is the an official subject to being charged criminally, in this case, in a federal court.
So does the plea assume for its purposes that the president has been impeached?
No.
So how does that work?
In this particular case, what's happened is they've used a questionable element of the Military Commissions Act, which was Bush's own law. At first, it was a presidential order to begin with, and then later was made into a law by the Congress for convening military tribunals. What's happened is that the president or the Secretary of Defense, or anyone that the president or the Secretary of Defense designate with the authority to identify enemy combatants, can bring someone to trial. And in this particular case, in this trial, a General Barbara Feldstone has been designated with that authority, and she has designated the president and the vice president as enemy combatants, and they've been arrested, and they are being held at undisclosed locations awaiting a military tribunal.
Playwright Todd Blakesley wrote A Patriot Act, The Trial of George W. Bush. It's a play that's being performed this month at California Stage in Midtown Sacramento. Todd, is there an actor who plays President Bush in this, or is he a character that's off stage?
There is always the impending possibility that President Bush will be brought into the courtroom. So I'm not going to reveal what happens there.
Okay. What about the jury?
The jury is made up of people that buy tickets to the theater.
So the audience is a jury?
Yes. The audience is a jury. The audience are also the witnesses at the trial.
I see. Well, let's bring into the conversation Ray Tatter, who's the artistic director of California Stage, which is presenting A Patriot Act. Ray, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Jeffrey.
Have you actually seen this play performed?
I have not, but when I read the script, I said, we must do this. I mean, California Stage, if you look at the seasons, tends to do work like this. We don't do Guys and Dolls or Hello, Dolly or the fifth revival of The Mousetrap.
Why must you do it? What is it about it that compelled you to do it?
Well, we believe that theater is a vital part of American cultural life and can actually bring us to greater understanding about what's happening in our country. And so we do a play that deals with, you know, these kinds of issues every year. I mean, last year we did a play, we did a musical on the life of Cesar Chavez. The year before that, we did a play called Clouds Hill, which dealt with a soldier coming back from Baghdad and his wife has become a peacenik. The year before that, we did a play called References to Salvador Dali. Clouds Hill was about bashing Middle Eastern students in colleges. It's about fear. And one teacher thinks that this kid is an Al-Qaeda plant.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the kinds of plays that we look for and we put into our season.
Todd, tell us more about how actively involved the audience is in the show.
Well, the kind of play that I like to work on is not, I'd like to get away from the idea that it's, quote, audience participation, because that conjures up a lot of sense of, like, I'm going to be dragged out of the audience and put on stage. And that isn't what happens. I do a type of theater that's called, I call it total immersion, for better, lack of a better term. People, when they arrive at the theater, there's already a situation that they have to deal with. And in this particular case, after they bought their ticket, they end up going through a security screening because it has to be secure before they're allowed to, you know, into the trial of the president. And they have some choices they can make. They can decide that they want to be on one of the three juries, or they may say that they want to be a defendant, a witness for the defendant, for President Bush, or a witness for the prosecution. Or they may choose to simply be a trial observer, but the option to get involved is always there. So they can just sit and watch if they want, but there's still the option to get involved.
What if no one in the audience wanted to be, was willing to be, say, a witness, for example?
There has never been a case that when you get a group of people together, there was a lack of desire to get up and say, speak for one side or the other.
Are there any witnesses, though, written into the script?
there are some there's some material that's written into the script so that certain kinds of evidence comes out, and sometimes that it ends up coming out from the audience people that are involved, and sometimes it comes out from our own people. But at the most, I would say 90% of your witnesses totally are audience people.
So, Ray, what percentage of what happens on stage is going to be rehearsed actors, and what percentage, roughly, is going to be members of the audience who are volunteering to be witnesses?
It's hard to tell because it is a structured improvisation in a sense that it's meant to prime the written part's meant to prime the pump to get the relationship between those folks who have said that they want to serve on a jury, those folks who have said that they want to act as witnesses, to get them working with it. So it's up to the lawyers, who are the lawyers for the defense and the lawyers for the prosecution and the magistrate, to make that system work. So it would vary. It could be anywhere from a third to a half.
There are so many strong opinions about President Bush on both sides. How are you prepared to deal with people turning up who are just going to stand up and rant on one side or another?
Yes.
Which might not be very entertaining for people or instructive to listen to.
Jeffrey, in a sense, this is like a town hall. You know, we used to go to the Grange Hall and talk about issues that were of vital importance to us. What happened to the town hall? So in a sense, this is a way where people can come and they can rant. They can express themselves. And I think that that's what the theater can act as a way of doing that.
Todd?
Well, I agree. Obviously, if somebody is becoming repetitive and so on, the judge has the opportunity to cut them off. But the overall goal is to allow people to say really what's on their mind. And that's to get them to stand up and say something, which they didn't, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, at a time when we got ourselves involved in an extraordinarily serious situation.
Are the audience members who are being witnesses, are they expected to play someone who would have been an actual witness? I don't know, someone who's in the U.S. Army or someone who is at Guantanamo Bay or whatever. Or are they being regular people expressing their opinions about President Bush?
They're regular people expressing their opinions. Occasionally, I will say this, that sometimes people have felt like, say they don't like President Bush. On occasion, someone may come up and think, you know, I want to be a witness for him just to feel what it's like. And they try to defend it. And that's part of what the theater offers as opposed to a cold, hard reality kind of situation. It's a playhouse. The way I like to do it is a playhouse for everyone so that they can try out different kinds of ethics. They can test their morals. They can, you know, say things that they didn't expect that they were going to say and not suffer the repercussions if the situation were real. The only repercussions they suffer is what they think of themselves afterwards.
Todd, how often has this play been performed?
I don't remember. It had a month run in San Diego about a year ago. So many performances in that month.
And how did it turn out, the trial in those performances in San Diego?
It turned out well.
I mean the verdict.
Oh, the verdicts are very interesting, and you have three possibilities. Either, remember, there are three different charges, and each charge has a different jury. So three juries render a verdict every night, and so you can either find him guilty or not guilty, or it's a hung jury. They're not able to make a decision. And in the case in San Diego, there out of all of them, there was about 40% were convictions and 60% were a combination of not guilty and hung jury. So you could say that basically he got off 60% of the time and was only convicted, 40% of the time. One of the things is that the jury actually at the end of the trial goes off and deliberates for a very short period of time, admittedly, but they do have time to get together in a room by themselves and they discuss it. So that's another drama that takes place that most of the audience doesn't get to see. And oftentimes there'll be one person who will say, I can't go that way. And it becomes a hung jury. And they come back and they tell us what happened.
Now, do you think that the verdicts come in because a certain percentage of the audience has come in with a fixed opinion about President Bush? Or is it your sense that the mood in the audience has shifted one way or another because of the testimony that's given by the witnesses? And this, of course, is testimony that's unpredictable. You don't know in advance what it's going to be.
It's a combination of both. Sometimes you'll get a hanging group in there. But again, you have several people on the jury. There's actually 6 people instead of 12 to make it a little more work a little tighter. And you'll get 5 that'll want to convict him and 1 person that'll stand up to him and say no, or vice versa. But the mood does shift. For example, let me give you one night. We had one night that was an Air America night, and we had Stacey Taylor from who has the show in San Diego was there. And was interviewed, was witness, and so on.
Not sympathetic to President Bush.
Not sympathetic to President Bush at all. And of course, they had promoted it on their program prior to that. And the audience was pretty much of an anti-Bush audience. That was the first night that on each of those juries, it was hung. They did not find a conviction because they started digging into, because things vary all the time. We're not trying to get every point, legal point across. They would argue about this, about technical matters, about their own moral issues, because there's a big underlying moral problem with this entire trial. And I'm not going to get into what that is. I'm going to leave that as a surprise. But sometimes that changes how people want to react, even though they came in with a preconceived idea.
Todd Blakesley is the playwright behind A Patriot Act, The Trial of George W. Bush, a play that's being performed this month at California Stage in Midtown Sacramento. He joins us. Also, Ray Tatter, who's the artistic director of California Stage. Now, Todd, the play had its first run in San Diego, which is a large place and lots of opinions there, but I believe it's a Republican-majority community. Do you expect a different reaction in Sacramento, which is probably a little bit more evenly divided, Republican-Democratic?
Do I expect a different reaction?
Yes.
No. I expect that those people that believe in President Bush, they need to come down and defend him. Those that believe that he has done serious damage to the country, they need to come down and be a witness against them. And this is the time to come forward and stand up if you haven't before.
Now, you said earlier that you didn't want to give away too much about President Bush in the play. Still, maybe there's some way for you to answer this question. Does the president speak on his own behalf in any way in the play, or does he take the fifth?
Most of the time, the president actually communicates to his defense counsel through a secure phone line.
Ah, okay. Right?
Yeah, I was going to say also. The interesting thing about this production is the fact that we were overwhelmed with people wanting to play a role in it when we opened up the auditions. And so the defense team and the prosecution team are peopled by real lawyers who can act.
Mm.
So you have the defense team headed out by a lawyer that actually teaches constitutional law at a local law library, Jeff Kravitz, local law school. Jeff Kravitz and Michael Garabedian, these are big-time lawyers in our town. As you know, it's filled with lawyers. William Bergen, Tiffany Schultz, Mark Stone works in law. So these are people who understand the law process, but they're working their way now through the theater process.
Now, Ray, you're one of the directors of this production. What role does a director play in a production that is at least partly improvised on the spot by people who you didn't know in advance?
Well, there are scenarios in any partly improvised play, and the idea to review those scenarios, to review changes. Okay. If you pick up the newspaper recently, you will see that there was a bill signed which allowed for wiretapping anywhere in the United States across the seas. So it's an amazing...
Although that bill did come out of a Democratic Congress.
Absolutely. So that needs to come forward in the in the argumentation. And these actors that we've put to the task will review all of those issues and put them forward through the interaction with people of who are witnesses.
And Todd, do you plan to keep working on this play through the end of President Bush's term in office?
And beyond.
And beyond. Todd Blakesley, Ray Tatter, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thanks.
That's A Patriot Act, The Trial of George W. Bush. It's being performed this month and into early October at California Stage in Midtown Sacramento. I'm Jeffrey Callison, host of Insight. Coming up, what one theater critic thinks of A Patriot Act. KXJZ is a listener-supported radio station. In other words, people like you help make the programs possible. In other words, if you're not a member, other people must step up to help cover the costs of your favorite shows. But that doesn't sound like you. Call or go online now and contribute to KXJZ. It's 800-800-5867, capradio.org. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Earlier, I talked with the writer and the director of the play A Patriot Act that's running this month in Sacramento. Now let's find out what one theater critic thought of it. He's Jeff Hudson. He reviews theater, among other things, for KXJZ News and the Sacramento News and Review. He's reviewed A Patriot Act, and he's in our studio. Jeff, welcome back to Insight.
Good to be here.
Well, you reviewed A Patriot Act for the Sacramento News and Review. What did you think?
Well, the first thing that occurred to me as I was watching the show is this is different than what I usually do as a reviewer, because usually I'm seeing a show and I'm going to tell you as a reviewer, well, this is kind of what it was like and what it was about. But of course, no two performances of A Patriot Act turn out the same, because you get different witnesses on any given night. You get different verdicts on different nights. And so I was trying to sort of describe the process. The night I saw the show, we got a guilty verdict. And in fact, Bush was given a term of over 140,000 years based on
oh, dear.
40 years for each American serviceman or servicewoman who died in Iraq. And that was how they arrived at that number. But there are nights when, you know, there's a hung jury or an acquittal. And so I can tell you some about the process. But of course, the show you see won't be the show that I saw.
Did it work dramatically, having this strong audience component?
I thought it was really interesting. And of course, being of an age that I watched the Watergate hearings on TV as a teenager back in the 1970s, I had that same kind of sense of I'm watching something unfold that has never really happened before. And so there was that element, if you were willing to invest that willing suspension of disbelief, you know, you're trotting down legally new ground. And so that was rather interesting. I really liked the way that the playwright worked in Dwight D. Eisenhower's speech about the military-industrial complex and how you had to be careful of that, and Jimmy Carter's quotes from the 1970s from a speech he made about America becoming overly dependent on foreign oil and how that'll really get us into trouble. There were some fine quotes by former presidents that sort of illuminated various scenes in the production.
My guest is Jeff Hudson. He's theater critic for KXJZ News and the Sacramento News and Review. And we're talking about A Patriot Act. Early in the program, I interviewed the playwright and the director. It's running in Sacramento this month and through early October. Now, the Sacramento Bee reviewed it as well, didn't like it very much, called it a long, didactic letdown. Can you agree with that in any way?
Well, I can also comment that Bruce Dances and I were at the same performance. And so this is one where you do have two people who were seeing the same thing. Like any courtroom procedure, I've served on juries and so forth. There are moments where it does tend to go on a little bit. On the whole, I would say that dramatically it wasn't quite as absorbing as the impeachment hearings that I watched, which really did have that kind of electric charge as you were watching them even on TV. But I still thought that the Patriot Act had a lot of interesting things going for it, and I would say it's probably more interesting as an experience and something to go through and think about than it is as a conventional play, because it's not a conventional play.
Sure. Bruce Dances of the Bee also didn't like the fact that the defendant, President Bush, gets no chance to speak for himself in the play. Was that a problem for you?
Well, I go back to when I was a teenager living in Marin County in the 1970s. I went to the San Quentin 7 trial I was actually called as a prospective juror, and the defendants were there but did not speak. They were in chains, and of course the defense attorneys were continuously objecting, saying that there was a presumption of guilt based on the fact that these defendants were wearing orange prison jumpsuits and were chained into their chairs and so forth and so on. So the fact that, George Bush wasn't present didn't necessarily disturb me all that much based on my experience at that trial.
Yeah. Let's talk about another theater work that's in Sacramento, but for a very short run, just last night and tonight. It's Daniel Beatty's play, one-man play, Emergency. And people who listen to Insight more often than just today will recall that yesterday we played an archive interview with him because he was in Sacramento in 2005 with the same show, and he's been brought back for these performances. And you went to see it last night.
Yes, and I should mention that it's at the Benvenuti Performing Arts Center in Natomas. If anybody wants to go see it this evening, I believe it's at 8 o'clock. It's an absolutely tremendous show, and Beatty has energy like very few performers I have ever seen. He is on stage constantly. He's changing in and out of 40-some characters, and he is just a fireball on stage. He sings. He trained at the Juilliard School in voice. He wrote the script, and he really gives just an absolutely amazing performance. This was the second time I had seen the show, and I was as impressed as I was the first time around.
Now, this guy is big time. Now, you saw his show Emergency, as you said, back in 2005 when he was doing it in Elk Grove. Has it changed in any way? Improved?
I think he's tightened it up. I think he's shortened up a few scenes. It seemed like it played just a little bit shorter this time around, and so he may have edited out just a few things. Not much. And, of course, in between the time I saw it in Elk Grove and the current appearance in Sacramento this week, he got it to New York, and it played in the Public Theater in New York, and he received an Obie Award, which is a very nice award. So I feel a little good as a reviewer. Hey, I saw it back then and gave it a rave review, and then it goes to New York and does very well. So that was nice for me.
And I think there were a few more people at last night's performance at the Benvenuti Performing Arts Center than in Elk Grove.
Yes, I would say they probably had, I'm just guessing, 150, 200 people, something like that.
Yeah.
And the performance in Elk Grove was really just a couple of dozen people at it.
Well, my guest is Jeff Hudson, theater critic for KXJZ News and the Sacramento News and Review. One other topic I want to talk about with you, Jeff, and I know you're working on this for KXJZ News for next week, and that is the imminent opening of the Gallo Center for the Arts in downtown Modesto. This is a big deal in the Modesto area. You've been down to the venue. What does it look like? And maybe more importantly, how does it sound?
I've actually been through the building three times now, about a year and a half ago, about 6 months ago, and again just a couple of weeks ago. The Gallo Center has been designed with sound in mind from the very, very beginning. They got Chris Jaffe, who's a prominent acoustic designer from New York, involved before they had started the drawings. And so it's been very carefully planned. And I was there on August the 30th when Jaffe was testing out the acoustics. And I can tell you safely, he had a smile on his face.
Yeah.
They had a trumpet. They had a piano. They had other things in there. And they were counting how many fractions of a second did the sound need to decay to the point that you couldn't hear it anymore. And so there was a nice reverb in there.
Well, California's two most famous wine families now have a state-of-the-art auditorium art center named for them, the Mondavi Center in Davis and the Gallo Center just about to open in Modesto. Are these two peas in a pod, or are they quite different from each other?
I would say they're quite different. The Mondavi Center is on a university campus. It's got an 1,800-seat main hall, which is big enough that they can host touring orchestras and so forth. And then the second space at the Mondavi Center is a 200-and-some-seat studio theater. The Gallo Center, the main hall, is 1,250 seats. So the furthest seat in the Gallo Center is only about 100 feet away from the proscenium arch over the stage. You're even closer in than at Mondavi. But 1,250 seats doesn't make for touring orchestras. The economics of a touring orchestra don't work so well. Gallo Center is right downtown, and so the restaurants are across the street. One of the things you'll hear people say about the Mondavi Center is that, you know, where do you eat? You have to get in the car and drive into downtown Davis or something to find a meal. So Gallo Center is right there in the middle of the community, and also the second space at the Gallo Center is a 440-seat proscenium arch theater, so it's a traditional-style space.
I just quickly looked over the program for the first year of the Gallo Center, and it seems like it's a bit more populist than the Mondavi Center program. Is that fair?
I think that's a correct perception, although the Mondavi Center programming is moving in that direction a little bit as well. They've got Doc Watson as one of their opening acts. The Gallo Center is not a university-sponsored entity. The Gallo Center is there as a community-centered thing, and so it's not sponsored with the same kind of college educational mission that UC Davis has for the Mondavi Center.
Well, of course, the Mondavi Center isn't just in Davis, but it's in a metropolitan area of more than 2 million with several universities and colleges and so on. Is there enough of a population in the Modesto area to support the Gallo Center? Any way to tell right now?
Oh, I think that there's plenty of support there for the Gallo Center. All kinds of people have moved to the Modesto area in the last few years, and I think there's a pent-up demand for a local performing arts center there. And, of course, a nice performing arts center is something that Modesto really hasn't had until this center has opened. So it's going to be a huge event. I know that when the Mondavi Center opened, they expected to sell a certain number of tickets, and they ended up selling way more tickets than they had first planned. And I'm sure that something like that will happen with the Gallo Center as well.
Well, Jeff Hudson, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And we'll look out for your reporting next week in the Gallo Arts Center. This is Insight on KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Public radio is a wonderful thing, I think, in large part because it's listener-supported. Seems so old-fashioned, and yet voluntary listener support is cutting-edge, too. It's how a lot of bloggers and people like that are supported online. Whether you're an old-school person or a new-school person, doesn't matter. You listen to the station, you like the programs, and you understand how public radio works. It's time to put it all together. Make a generous contribution. Call 800-800-5867 or go online to capradio.org.